stations promise outstanding content, but when it's time to deliver, they fall flat on their ridiculous faces. Enter LA Talk Radio, a cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk station that delivers totally original content without any commercials. Log on to latalkradio.com and get involved with the best talk radio station on the internet. LA Talk Radio, we say what we want.
The morning show that's on your side. But then again, so is appendicitis.
And now, broadcasting live from the palatial studios of LA Talk Radio, you're listening to Sam and Steph in the Morning. If you'd like to take part in the show today, please dial 323-203-0815. And now, here are your program hosts, Sam and Steph, only on LA Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Thursday. It's October 13th. It's not quite Friday the 13th, but... Right?
Close enough, right?
Thursday the 13th.
Good morning.
Good enough for me. Good morning to you. You're looking all bright and happy this morning, full of energy.
Second day, yeah. Having breakfast.
Oh, wow. So that's what it's about, huh?
It is, seriously.
Well, you discovered something good. Maybe now I'm going to start that, too.
You should.
In fact, I forgot. I was going to do it this morning, but I got to plan ahead what the hell I'm going to eat in the morning.
You know? It can be something simple, Sam. Yeah. Yogurt and a banana.
That's true. That's
what really
I'm going to
have.
It really does. Okay.
Gets your day off.
I'll
the
have
right
that
start.
Ready for tomorrow.
Yeah. What's up with this weather? Seriously.
Yeah, it's gotten really hot, huh?
Yesterday I was
again.
Sweating.
Yeah.
My balls off.
Yeah.
I don't have balls though.
But they were sweating regardless.
Yeah, right. Sweating your balls off. You just never know what's underneath.
Yeah. Now you live by the beach. Is it still very hot there?
Manhattan Beach, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's ridiculously hot.
Really?
Yeah, it was weird. I mean, I'm not on the beach.
Right.
So I'm assuming on the beach it's a little more windy.
Yeah, it is cooler.
But everywhere in this whole city, it's just been very hot, and today's supposed to be the same way.
Yeah. Oh, well, you know, we wanted Southern California, so that's what we get, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Can't complain.
You got any big plans for the weekend?
Oh, good question. No, you know, well, for the last week and a half has been ridiculous. I filmed and then got back and did that Microsoft convention. So this weekend is pretty much relaxing. I might be seeing the Foo Fighters perform tomorrow night.
Really?
Kind of excited about that.
Wow,
yeah.
How cool.
Other than that, no, I'm taking it easy.
Yeah.
But you know what? Those are the weekends, seriously, that end up being the most ridiculous.
Yeah, because you get into trouble.
Yeah. I'm going to be in trouble. I can't believe I just said sweat my balls off. I'm going to really get some shit for that. Anyway.
It's okay. It's innovative, you know? It's something new. Yeah. Something fresh and new.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
I really am a dude. By the way, did you hear about the 8 people dead at the Salon shooting?
Yeah, down in Seal Beach or
something? Seal Beach. That's, I guess, in Orange County?
Right.
Is that
something
crazy
like
or
that.
What?
Yeah.
Very small town, super small salon.
Very
it seems like
back.
A very family-owned business.
Right.
Yeah, I couldn't believe that. And it appears to be an ex-boyfriend of
one of the girls that worked there.
Yeah.
Wow.
I was actually watching the news right when it came on, and at first it was, I believe, 6 people dead, 3 in critical condition, and then obviously 2 of those 3 people died.
Wow.
Yeah, and now 1 is in critical condition. That's just ridiculous.
It is. It's very scary, you know? I mean, you go to McDonald's, people shoot at you, you know? You go to the hair salon, shoot at you.
I don't know. I just can't imagine.
I know.
Getting your hair
terrible.
Done and then automatically, you know, somebody just runs in and...
Yeah.
The weird thing about it, though, is, I mean, this obviously was a small salon. I'm thinking, like, why didn't any of these people run out? I mean, he must have, you know, locked them in or blocked the door somehow.
Yeah, if he blocked the door, that's it.
8 people, you know, 9 people in the salon total.
Right.
I would think I'd be running for my life.
Yeah.
I mean, I would be going ape shit on that guy.
Yeah.
You know?
If you had a chance. I don't know. Yeah. It's easy to judge when we're on the sidelines, you know?
Right.
But when you're there, I think it gets pretty scary.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Well, what are you going to do, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway,
sorry for their families.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I know. It's very shocking when these things happen, you know, because like you said, it's a small town, you know, people don't expect that.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But I guess there's jealous boyfriends everywhere.
Yeah, you just don't know what's going to go on in someone's mind, you know, especially when it comes to love and heartbreak.
Yeah.
You know, some people really do. It just turns you crazy.
Yeah.
Who knows?
I know, especially possessive men.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Or women.
Yeah. Or women, I guess. Yeah.
Or women with balls.
Yeah. You're not going to let that one go.
No.
Huh? Well, at least you're the one who said that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. All right. Well, Steph, we have a great guest in the studio, very special guest, and his name is Phil Day. Good morning.
Good morning to you all.
And Phil has just made an incredible film. I mean, I've read a little bit about it and saw the trailer, and so we're going to talk to you about that in a minute. And okay, so we'll get to the trailer in just a second. I'm like all over the place here. I had an article I was going to discuss called "Are Female Orgasms a Bonus?" You know,
what?
So but we need a little more time for that, so we'll talk about that later. It's not quite along the line of why Phil is here, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
I didn't realize that was going to be my specialty.
Yeah. Yeah. So welcome to the show, Phil.
Thank you.
And you're apparently from Britain, right? From Great Britain?
Yeah.
UK,
from
whatever.
London.
Yeah. From London. How long have you been here?
6 years in the US and all of them in Santa Monica.
Yeah. Well, nice. I don't blame you. Santa Monica is nice. So what made you move here?
Opportunities and a bigger vista. London was starting to get a little familiar. I'm a motorcyclist, and I'd ridden down every street in London.
Really?
And
so that got old?
I realized that it was time to move on and find a new vista, and we're bigger than California.
Yeah.
This is the best place to have a motorcycle.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful ride.
So are you finding it a nice home so far?
Yeah, it's terrific. It's not always easy to live in Los Angeles. It's a different city with people don't rub shoulders like they do in London. Everybody's
that's
in a
true.
Car with sunglasses on and the windows
the
up and the air conditioning.
There.
Yeah, we all ride around in our single cars. So that's it. Very different, but it's a beautiful place and there's lots of beautiful people here and it's lent me a lot of opportunities.
Wonderful. So you were born in London. Right?
Outside
of London?
Yeah.
And you grew up there. What kind of childhood did you have there? I mean, was it rough? What kind of a neighborhood did you grow up in?
No. I might seem rough, but no.
I know. I'm like, what? What do you mean?
Where's this leading? Funny enough, I actually grew up...
Trying to find interesting angles.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, well, this will surprise you. Most of my formative years were spent in Africa.
Oh, really?
Yeah, my parents moved to Africa when I was a kid.
Uh-huh.
And
where in Africa?
To Zambia.
Uh-huh.
And I went to one of those poshest schools in Africa.
Uh-huh.
And it was an extraordinary experience. It was like going back in time 50, 60 years.
Wow.
Very strange. So by the time I came back, I was already a late teen and moved to London and sort of discovered life from there on in.
Right.
So Africa was very much removed from... You know, my English experience.
Yeah, obviously. And how old were you when you moved to Africa?
10.
10. Okay, so you'd already known what it's like to live in London and everything, but
yeah.
Then you moved. So, wow, that's pretty cool. So, I mean, did you ever, like, get used to living there in Zambia? I mean, it's like, it's a totally different world.
I became an African.
Yeah.
I really did. I spoke the local language.
Uh-huh.
I hung out with mainly African people.
Wow.
And from where I was born... There was very few black people around, so this was a big change in my life.
Right. Wow. That's pretty interesting stuff. Could you live in Africa?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I'm very adventurous. I wouldn't mind living pretty much anywhere in this world.
Yeah.
For, I mean, you know, temporary, not a permanent move. I think, you know,
right.
The U.S. is my main residence. But I lived in Germany for 3 years.
Yeah, well, Germany's not
kid.
Africa,
right.
You know?
I know. Yeah, it's different. No, I have a friend in South Africa. And
yeah, South Africa is different. I lived
it
in
is.
South Africa for a year, too.
Did you? Cool.
Yeah, South Africa is not Africa, you know? It's more like the United States.
Is it? But there's still so many animals. Like,
oh, yeah, yeah. It's beautiful there. I love the place, you know? But it's not like Zambia, you know? I mean, you go there and it's a whole different thing, you know? Was there like a lot of poverty and stuff around you there or
absolutely.
Really?
Yeah, I mean we were among the only white people around and most Africans lived in abject poverty. It was very apparent as a kid you're kind of a little bit surprised by it, but there's not much you can do about it.
Yeah.
But they were great people. I like their music, I like their food.
Yeah.
And you know, I learned all the bad things there. I learned how to smoke and how to drink with those guys. So I owe them a lot.
Very
yeah,
cool.
Obviously, yeah.
That had to be interesting, learning about the culture. I love that.
Yeah.
I think it's what made me a documentarian was seeing other people's worlds and being fascinated by
it. Yeah, and learning to observe what's going on and stuff, yeah. So now, what was the reason your parents moved to Africa? I don't know if you said
opportunities.
That.
My dad was in a sort of decent enough job as an accountant, and suddenly this opportunity came up to be much better paid, nice house, and the kids were going to be sent to first-class school there.
Wow. That's a big move, but obviously it left a good impression on you, so that's a good
thing. Yeah, I remember my mom saying, your life will never be the same, but it'll be better.
Oh, wow.
I like that.
Yeah. There you go. There's a positive mom for you.
Mm-hmm.
My mom would not have been like that. She'd be like, don't go there. Are you kidding? Are you crazy?
Very supportive.
Yeah.
Great family, Sam.
Yeah. So so you moved back to London, and what did you do then? You were like, what, 16 or something?
Yes, 16, 17.
Yeah.
Finished school, went to university in London, and was doing a Bachelor of Arts in Film and Television.
I see. So you found your interest in film early on.
Yeah, funny enough, I actually came to America I did a gap year, what we call a gap year in Europe, which is when between school and university. And it's actually, you know, greatly encouraged in Europe, not so much encouraged here. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a great benefit to the individual because you kind of learn more about yourself in that 1 year than you would if you just carried on in school. So by the time you go back to school, you're more determined and you're more focused.
Right.
And so I came out to America, mm-hmm. and it was kind of when I first fell in love with California. I lived in San Francisco for a year.
Uh-huh.
And I'll tell you a story very briefly, is that I was living downstairs with some friends, and upstairs they were making a porn film.
Welcome to California.
Yeah, really. And so first of all, they asked me to get involved in it, you know, personally. And I said, no, I don't think I'm quite up for that. But I said I'd be fascinated to join in and, you know, get involved in the editing or whatever. So I was the assistant to the assistant editor.
Nice.
On this porn film. and I thought, yeah, this is fun, but the process, I loved it. I could just tell that it was really kind of familiar to me.
Right.
And so I got involved, and then I decided that that was it. I was going to become a filmmaker.
Really? Wow.
From a porno?
Yeah,
from a porno. I love that. What a story. That's awesome.
And how old were you when you did this porn thing?
18.
18. You see? Yeah, he didn't wait very long. Yeah.
Brilliant.
Great. Just old enough.
Did you continue doing some porno?
No. From that point on, it was just that one-off opportunity. Funny enough, 10 years later,
uh-huh.
10 years later, I was accepting the Golden Gate San Francisco Film Festival Award for the best film, and gave that story to the audience, and brought the house down. I thought that was hilarious.
I bet. We've all had similar experiences. Porno, I think, has walked into our lives in some tiny extent.
I want to hear.
You can tell us about it.
I see, you know, directors, writers, post-production, or even actors. It's kind of walked into our life for a very brief moment.
sex sells. It sure does. It's been one of those oldest sellers in the world, probably, mm-hmm. and television is no different.
Yeah,
sex is always sold.
Yeah, it's because it's such an integral part of our life, and yet people won't talk about it in a personal way, you know. And I mean, now we talk about it freely and so forth, but it's still such a private thing. And yet,
in the U.S., in other countries, like even Europe, it's like, what? You know, I'm walking naked down the street.
Yeah.
I think it's very interesting that here we're more likely to see people getting their heads blown up. Mm-hmm. Than we are a nipple.
Yeah.
And I think,
like in a movie, you mean?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I just think there's a sort of disparity between the two worlds, and I don't understand it being European.
Right.
Why there's such a strange obsession about our bodies here, and yet you can, you know, I saw a film last night called Drive, which was a great film.
Yes, you were talking about it.
Ryan Gosling. No, Eyes of March.
No,
but the one I saw. Oh, the other one, though, the Ryan Gosling Drive.
Right?
I haven't seen that yet.
Oh, it's, I mean, it's a great film, but it's so violent.
Really?
It's so violent.
Wow.
I just love Ryan Gosling.
I know.
That's terrific.
A little crush.
Yeah.
A little crush.
I can
see
why.
But I've read a few books on American society and so forth, and we are really characterized by a lot of violence, you know, and I don't know why that is. People are so fascinated. I mean, you look at best-selling books, and it's like serial murderers.
And video games.
Yeah, and things like that, you know, and then you go to the movies, the same thing. And the more explosions, the more blood, it seems to be, you know, the better. But then you got involved in all this, and, you know, and I want to get to your film. Did we cover everything? Yeah, I guess the porn and everything like that. So we've covered Africa.
The drum roll intro.
Yeah. So, but I think this is a good segue because we're talking about violence and so forth. But, yeah, I really do believe that our society is preoccupied with violence too much, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, now, so you you made a few films, and the latest one is Crime Lords of Tokyo. Now, tell us a little bit about this, just first a synopsis of what the film's about.
First, I don't want to be boastful, but I've actually made over 100 documentaries.
Wow.
That's crazy.
In a 20-year career. So,
wow, that's a lot.
I am very proud of every one of them as a little child for me.
Right.
But this one I'm most proud of.
Yeah.
This one was a very personal journey. My very first film was set in Tokyo. Mm-hmm. And it was the one that I was picking up the award for at San Francisco International Film Festival.
Oh, nice.
And it was about Japan, and it was very much about sort of theater and arts and performance and, you know, sort of very much involved in what I was interested in at the time.
Right.
And then 20 years on, I got an opportunity to go back to make a film about the Yakuza, the Japanese gangsters, the Japanese mafia. And it was an extraordinary journey for the three of us who went. Myself, Carl Greenwood, and Aaron Even, my writer and co-directors. And it was a small team, and we had to get inside a world that's phenomenally secretive. I mean, they do not generally open up to anybody at all, period.
Right.
It's a legal organization, but doing illicit crimes. So it's a strange dichotomy. They actually allowed to exist in Japan.
I see. Okay. Wow. That's interesting.
And there's 80,000 members of this organized crime group. It's the biggest organized crime group in the world. And they usually extort money through, through local businesses for security and that kind of thing. But they're also involved in the stock market and industry and a lot of construction and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But people will always speak off the record, but you won't find them easily speaking on the record. So
right.
To get the access that we did was a lot of cajoling and convincing that we will hide their identity or we will sort of make sure that their faces are blurred and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Wow. Let's play the trailer of the film just so we know a little bit about what we're talking about. And this is Crime Lords of Tokyo.
In modern-day Japan, there's an ancient brotherhood of gangsters known as Yakuza. Secretive organizations that control a criminal empire. Now, a top boss reveals the true face of his crime syndicate. A young woman tries to escape a life of violence. And one gangster proves his loyalty through one of Japan's oldest rituals. Deep inside the forbidden world of the Yakuza.
That's awesome, man.
It's intense.
Yeah, it makes me want to see it, really. And I get to see the video also. But they're known for their ruthlessness, right?
Yeah, they are very involved in all aspects of Japanese society. And most Japanese people have had some experience of the Yakuza.
Mm-hmm.
And most Japanese people are not prepared to speak about them. They're extremely fearful of them. Japanese society is very structured and very ordered. And so it's difficult to know just how much violence it takes to frighten people in Japan.
Mm.
Not possibly as much as it does anywhere, but I think Japan's very special and unique in that its ordered society means that anybody who goes off of that order and structure
mm-hmm.
is really a scary individual to the more ordered structured sort of individuals in society. So they are fearful of them. There is many examples of violent actions against individuals, mm-hmm. And a lot of threats. And I think in Japan that's just as scary as actual threats, because, as I say, it's a very crime-free country compared to our own.
Oh, okay. So that's why that stands out so much, because it's in such contrast from the society. Now, what do you mean by structured society? Explain a little bit about that on the Japanese.
Well, I think in America, everybody is given the freedom to be an individual, and that anybody, apart from Arnold Schwarzenegger, can become the president. Mm-hmm. You know, if you have given this born right to become anything you want to be, and that's a great thing in America, and it's sort of what America stands for. In Japan, you are born into a rigid structure that you are involved in. Whatever aspect you're born into, that's where you are, that's where you stand. So if you're a high individual, that's mm-hmm. where everybody sees you as. If you're a lowly individual, that's where you stay. Yeah. You can't rise up above it very
right.
easily.
So you're sort of like born into a family, and whatever their social status is, that's what you're into.
It's a caste system, a social
yeah,
structure.
Yeah, right, exactly. And yeah, many countries are like that in Asia, you know, like I think in India it's the same thing. You know,
absolutely.
Caste system there. So they stay in their social status for the rest of their lives, pretty much?
Pretty much. It's once you know where you stand in Japan, that's it. You don't move above it. If you're middle management, you're born into middle management, you die into middle management.
Wow.
You're not given that sort of freedom of choice as you are here.
Right.
So, but having said that, it's not necessarily a negative thing. It just means that everybody knows where they stand.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Well, people wouldn't stand for that in America, I'm sure, you know.
Right, but even so, like when you're born, that's just like even with religion here, you know, if I'm born into a Catholic family, I'm growing up Catholic for the most part until I turn 18 and decide right. to venture off.
Right, but I think he means also somewhat. Beyond the age of 18, you're like that, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
You can't break out of it.
Very interesting.
Adulthood.
Yeah, can you imagine, I mean, being born into something and not being able to break away from it?
Why is that, though? What are the consequences of breaking out? I mean...
It's difficult for me, I'm not an anthropologist, to mm-hmm. really hazard a guess. I mean, the main thing is that every part of Japanese structure, their language, for instance, the way that you speak to somebody senior and somebody lower than you is very, very, very finite.
Wow.
You use certain words to somebody and different words to somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
So it's incredibly... incredibly structured is the best way of deciding it. But I think... Therefore, when these crime lords turn up and start to threaten the structure,
right.
it really does frighten people. I mean, we had a lot of people that refused to be involved in the film mm-hmm. because it was about the Yakuza.
Right. Mm-hmm. And they're afraid.
Very afraid.
Wow.
So I'm so these crime lords, though, in regards to the whole structure thing, crime lords, I mean, you're born into the crime, or can you not be born into that, and you then how do you become a member of the mafia in a way?
Right. Well, most kids sort of, there's a lot of poverty in Japan that's not really ever reported, a lot of difficulties mm-hmm. in society as well. Mm-hmm. And so in the rougher areas where you get less opportunities, parents aren't able to keep control over their kids as they are in the more middle class areas. And so in those working class areas, you'll find that they go out and they're causing trouble, and then the gangs will actually start to gather them together and invite them into their organization.
Yeah.
And it seems like a cool idea, because the Japanese mafia, the Yakuza, they have the best suits, they have the coolest cars, they mm-hmm. have the best haircuts.
Yeah.
And they are like you see them in the movies. Mm-hmm. That's what they look like in yeah. real life.
Hardcore. Yeah.
And you can see them in Kabukicho is the red light district of Tokyo.
Mm-hmm.
And they are standing very openly on every street corner.
Really?
And you can always tell the Yakuza because they really do have the coolest suits.
Yeah.
They really do have the best haircuts. They're quite the best sunglasses. They really do look the part.
I always thought that was just like a cliche, you know, when you see it in the movies. Oh, you know, they're always dressed in the best suits. That's so weird hearing that it actually is.
It is so true. You can see them on every street corner. And we got taken around by this one Chinese guy who was risking life and limb, but he didn't seem to care. To introduce us to people, and we got taken around, and he was drunk actually on the night that we went out, and he was introducing us to these guys and saying, oh, this is our Yakuza friends, and they were stood next to a huge Mercedes that said 893 on it, and Yakuza in Japanese is 893.
Really?
So if ever you see the number plate 893, you know for sure. Run for the hills.
Wow. This is also interesting to me. So what would make like the Yakuza? That's how you say it?
Yakuza.
Yakuza, I'm horrible. What would make them want to, I don't know, attack a certain group? Or like, what is it specifically that draws them to, I want. Do you know what I mean?
Okay, well, it's territorial, like a lot of gang members are here. It's all about territory. And there is a boss at the top of the pyramid, and everybody pays. Money flows upwards. Mm-hmm. And so if you want to be a member of the Yakuza, you have to pay your dues. And so what they do is that they extort money from local businesses for protection. Mm-hmm. And so that they can pay their boss, who pays his boss, who pays his boss, and it goes up in a pyramid. Mm-hmm. And so if you move into an area as a local business, then you can become a target very quickly for the Yakuza to come and take protection money from you.
I see.
And it's happened in America over the years. I don't know how much it's inherent in certain areas of New York, for instance. Mm-hmm. You still get the mafia working in a protection racket like that.
Right.
I'm not privy to that information, so I'm not going to hazard too much of a guess on how regular that is in America. But in Japan, especially in the larger provinces, it's incredibly inherent.
Mm. Wow. So now, had you lived in Japan for a while before you started the film? I mean, you had to at least feel comfortable there, right? With the language,
well,
with the people?
My co-director, Calder Greenwood, he speaks fluent Japanese. He lived there for a couple of years.
Mm.
I've had a lot of experience over there, and we worked with people who do live there permanently. So unfortunately, with television being the way it is, the budgets aren't nearly as big as we would want for something like this. So you can't afford to just go and spend 9 months. This is a film for National Geographic. It's a commissioned film, and so there's a set budget, it's tight budget, and you have to make everything work within that budget. So we had 3 weeks from departure to departure.
Really?
Yeah, so it was really tight. So we did a lot of groundwork prior to going.
Before.
I got a great production team who work tirelessly to get involved in, you know, sort of finding us ways in, best deals, good fixers, mm-hmm. production fixers that are going to help us out there. But what we found was that it wasn't until we got there that we really did get involved. There was a lot of talk as before we got there, mm-hmm. but then as soon as we got there, we realized, okay, we need to knock on doors. We need to be calling around anybody and everybody to see who knows somebody. And that's the thing.
Yeah.
It's like turning up in a town and, you know, finding the best restaurant or something like that,
right.
is you ask people.
Right.
And somebody knows something who knows somebody
people,
who knows
where the hell's the mafia around here?
Exactly.
And, oh my God.
And they're so prevalent that it didn't take too long for people to come out the woodwork and say, yeah, I know, but I don't want to be on camera. And so slowly but surely we got to people who were prepared to talk. They had a story to tell.
Mm-hmm.
And like most people, you know, you need to find the people who've got a story to tell. And if they've got a story to tell, they want to tell it. And that's why we're there. We're the psychologists of television. We're there to hear people's stories.
Right. Now, I wanted to ask you, let's get a little bit into the filmmaking part of this and stuff. Now, when you do a documentary, do you have to script it in advance? I mean, do you know what you're going to find? You obviously can't know, right?
No, we actually really struggled to start with, to be honest. Yeah. I work with a writer, Aaron Eve, in Washington, and we collaborate on all our stories. And he and I just pulled our hair out trying to figure out what the hell this story was going to be about, mm-hmm. because every day it was changing.
Right.
And you'd find, okay, so for instance, the first person that we got was a cop who was a retired cop who just retired, and he'd been chasing down the Yakuza for years.
Mm-hmm.
And so he talked off the record to start with, and then we persuaded him to talk on the record. And so when he was talking off the record, the script was one way.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he...
juicy, probably, right?
Yeah, and then he agreed to talk on the record, and then suddenly the script changed all over again.
Mm-hmm.
And then another day, we got access to two Yakuza brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And that completely changed everything.
Mm.
It was the first time that we'd been in close proximity of Yakuza members, and it was a very interesting experience and really did change my attitude to them. I realized that they were incredibly honorable, scary, mm-hmm. but honorable. And being a Westerner, I didn't feel threatened by them, strangely.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I felt anxious and nervous, sure. but I wasn't scared. I didn't think that my life was in danger.
That's good. I was going to ask, at any point in those 3 weeks, did you come across a situation where you did think, yikes, I'm in trouble?
There was a couple of times when I trouble bolted the hotel door. we were getting calls in the dead of night and saying, we don't want you to come back to Kabukicho, to the red light area.
No way.
Ever again. Oh, yeah.
That really? Would freak me out.
Oh, yeah.
Holy cow.
But you went back, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Being a dumb filmmaker is we don't like people to tell us what we can and can't do. So,
sure.
You know, we have to work within the confines. My main important, you know, as a producer and as the owner of the company that produces for National Geographic, I have to protect my crew first and foremost, but I don't have to protect myself.
Right.
That's just to my family.
You daredevil.
So, but I don't like being told what I can't do by anybody.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we kind of decided we'd go back.
Yeah.
But I gave the crew the option not to.
Yeah.
And we're all pretty gung-ho about it in a positive way. You know, we didn't want to pin somebody down and say bad things about them. We just wanted to understand them.
Right.
And, you know, as I say, the psychologists of television filmmakers is you want to understand how people tick, why they do what they do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not there to reveal to the police some criminal action.
Right.
I'm there to try and understand it so that the public, whether they're Americans watching this show who want to go to Japan and feel safe and comfortable going there,
right.
or just that we're fascinated by worlds in which we don't normally get access to.
Yeah, that's true.
I'm curious, though, okay, as the producer of this documentary, you know, you're capturing these unbelievable, you know, people that are part of the mafia and doing illegal things. Can't somebody watch this documentary and then, I mean, demand the information from you? I mean, police can't come to you and then just say, who are these people? You're in like a contract that I just don't understand how some, you know, cops or whomever wouldn't be tempted to come to you.
Rarely do they have the right to do that. I mean, there are examples in documentary filmmakers being told to hand over materials. We guard that with our lives. That's what we trade on.
Mm-hmm.
Our honor is what we trade on. And certainly in this instance, my word was my bond, and I would, you know, I would follow my sword rather than hand over material to anybody.
Yeah.
I in fact told my funders that they couldn't have various material from me, National Geographic, because I'd given my word that information wouldn't go out to anybody else. It was private.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so somebody has to really have good reason to think that I've got something that is worth all the hassle to get it. And also, the American police aren't going to be interested.
Right.
I am operating as an American,
right.
Even with a British accent. And so they'd be hard pushed to find any reason to come to me. And the Japanese police are not that obtrusive in our world, you know. Mm. And it is our world, it's a Western world, so they'd have to sort of really challenge diplomatic circles to be able to take information from me.
Really? Wow, that's pretty interesting. Yeah, because you're more like an observer, you know, and like a reporter, and, you know, where it's also known people don't reveal their sources and so forth. So
yeah, it's I'm a doctor in different clothing.
Yeah.
I like that.
A doctor. Cool. Yeah. I remember seeing a movie, wasn't it Black Rain with Michael Douglas about the Yakuza and all that? That was like a few years back, but I remember, I mean, they are very, very ruthless. Can you discuss that a little bit? I mean, did you see any... You probably didn't see any acts of violence right in front of you, or did you?
No. We were told about acts of violence.
Right.
Directly by the Yakuza members. And those are the guys that said they wanted their identity hiding in the film. And so everybody's blurred out and their voices are changed so that nobody can recognize them.
Mm.
Only I know.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
That's really neat.
Wow. So so how long, you said in a week you did this movie?
No, three weeks.
Three weeks. That's right.
Yeah, it was a hell of an adventure. The first week was actually almost useless. Just sort of, you know, getting over jet lag and running up to speed. So the last 2 weeks were pretty hairy to find the entire story, go out, film it, persuade people to be on camera.
Yeah.
What we did do, and I might explain to your listeners, is that we shot all the documentary elements in Tokyo.
Mm-hmm.
But all the recreations, this is a trade secret here, but all the recreations were actually shot here in Los Angeles.
I see.
And
okay.
So what we did was we recreate the stories told to us with Japanese actors based here.
Right. That's what I saw in the trailer, and I couldn't understand. I mean, because you guys had, like, really nice shots of the tattooed actors and so forth. And I thought, you know, I mean, these can't be real people, you know?
Right, well, yeah. A lot of my company specializes in dramatic recreations of great stories. So,
wow.
So what we do is we get the firsthand stories from individuals who are involved in whatever story we're covering. And then we recreate that as dramatically and accurately as possible. And there's a lot of great drama in these stories. Mm-hmm. One of the stories, Stephanie, you might be interested in,
yes,
is a female who was born into a Yakuza family. Her father was the Yakuza boss of the Sumiyoshikai, which is the second biggest group in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a young child, would see her father talking to all these guys with tattoos and everything. And one day she hears some noises in the night and she walks down the corridor. And we retell this story in dramatic recreation in the film. And she sees her father receiving this atonement, which is the most strangest part of Japanese culture, or the Yakuza culture, is an individual gangster, when he's done something wrong, he cuts off his own pinky finger.
What?
Wow.
And then he presents that to his boss as a, you know, prayer for forgiveness, for the boss's forgiveness for whatever stupid mistake.
He cuts his own finger off.
Yeah. So it's cut off at the either the first or the second knuckle of your pinky finger.
Yeah.
Wow.
And we saw guys with only six fingers left, or, you know, two thumbs.
Oh, my
gosh.
Wow.
So they had,
that's every time they do something wrong, they have to do this.
It has to be pretty bad to do something. Like, one guy we talked to who was a gangster turned preacher, he has his finger cut off, and that came about by him crashing. He drove his boss's car, his nice Mercedes.
Mm.
He was drunk, uh-huh, and he crashed it. And as his atonement,
uh-huh,
he cut off his own finger. But
wow,
he couldn't quite do the actual cutting.
Uh-huh.
So he got his friend
to
cut it off for him. So again, we recreate that great story in there.
Oh,
it's not too graphic. It's not like Drive, but it's pretty graphic. And
reenactments are great, though, because it gives the viewer, you know, an actual visual thing,
right,
as opposed to just hearing the person speak about it in front of the camera.
Yeah.
That's great. That is crazy.
Yeah.
Oh, I can't even imagine.
So if ever you see a Japanese guy with his pinky fingers cut off, you know for absolutely certain that is a Yakuza.
Wow.
But you said a few of his fingers were missing, so once they cut off the pinky, then they go on to the next one.
Exactly. You think this guy was a doofus.
Yeah, wow.
Is that the only kind of source of punishment? Or, I mean, are there other ways? Or do they actually, will they kill you if you do something horribly wrong?
Yeah, there's undoubtedly sort of worse punishments, but they're a very honorable group, the Japanese generally, and certainly the Yakuza are very honorable. There is a code of conduct there that has to be strictly carried out.
Right.
And so being Japanese, you understand these codes of conduct. Mm. You know, here it's a bit anarchic, every man for themselves, every man and woman for themselves. Mm-hmm. In Japan, you kind of understand your order in life, and so you follow through. So a boss is a boss, and you respect them. But undoubtedly, there have been murders for sure. Yakuza to Yakuza is the most common.
Mm.
You're more likely to hear of a gangster being murdered. Guns aren't very common at all in Japan, which I think is a great thing. Being British, I'm not a fan of guns. And you see yesterday what you were talking about at the beginning of the show, 8 people murdered. Well, that wouldn't have happened if guns were illegal. Mm-hmm. I don't want to get onto this for long. I hope no NRA people are listening in and hate me. But, it would not have happened if the guy had a sword or a knife. He wouldn't have gone in there and killed 8 people.
Yep.
So in Japan, you don't hear of multiple murders like that.
Mm.
Guns are very uncommon. And the punishment for being caught with a gun is really draconian. Mm. So they tend to use sort of more honorable weapons like swords, which sounds scary, but I'd prefer a sword, in society than a gun.
Sure, at least you have a chance to survive. My God.
So there's definitely knifings that you hear of. One writer that we tell the story of in the film kept on writing negative things about the Yakuza. And one day he was stabbed in the back by a Yakuza member. He survived and is still writing bad things about the Yakuza. So they're not nearly as violent as perhaps some groups are in other parts of the world.
Right.
I wouldn't like to do that with some of the Hispanic groups, for instance.
Mm. Right.
So I think they are violent, but a lot of it is driven by the fear factor rather than actual...
Right, like the intimidation.
Yeah, the intimidation. Yeah.
Right, yeah. Now, would you compare more to the mob in the United States or to gangs? More to
the mob.
More to the mob.
Yeah, the mob was driven by families that were, relatively honorable. So, you know, the Italian mafia has got a great deal of honor involved in it, and you break that code at your peril.
That's true.
The same thing with the Yakuza. I don't know the gangs well enough. I've made a couple of films here. We made one last year, Born to Rage. But my feeling was it was a bit more random acts of violence and more like street gangs as opposed to a structured pyramid, organized crime group.
Right. So the structure is different, you're saying?
Yeah, it's much more of a pyramid structure. There is a peak of the... Yakuza, is led by one guy who's the sort of authority on it. So the Yamaguchi-gumi is the biggest group with 40,000 members, and it's the guy. He's currently, I think, he's been released this month actually from prison. But there is one member, and it's a bit like Gotti, the Godfather in on the East Coast.
Right.
Is that we know about them, we know of them, and it's just the police are looking for an opportunity to pin them down with some criminal act that they can actually pin on them and put them behind bars.
Right. Wow. Yeah. It's like I think about this. Now, it's like you're talking about like a pyramid. It's like a multi-level marketing type of a thing, you know?
It is. I mean, they're very... They've got fingers in a lot of pies in the commercial world as well.
Yeah.
Whether it's the stock market, for sure. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of money laundering through building.
Mm-hmm.
So they've got a lot of connections in making concrete, for instance. Building buildings.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's an awful lot of high-level finance going on. There's we know that they've bought golf courses in America with mafia money.
Really?
Yeah. some in Los Angeles. And they have definitely infiltrated America, but not in a way that, you know, the public needs to be concerned about.
Right.
But it's politically, they're not allowed to buy in this country if they're a known mafia member. So they have to launder the money through other members, through other connections, as it were. But if you're a known, if you're a known member of the Yakuza, you're not allowed to come to America.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Wow.
I don't blame them.
They won't. You know? They won't give.
Who wants them here?
A visa.
Yeah.
This is kind of random. I just have a quick question. Females, are they allowed to be part of Yakuza, or is it just males?
It is a male-only organization. The females are definitely.
I'm a feminist.
No, and it's a very good question. There's a very dynamic woman in the film, Shoko Tendo, who I was mentioning before. She was this daughter of the boss, and her father fell on bad times, and ultimately she was sold into prostitution to try and pay off the family debt.
Really?
Effectively. And she fought against the guy. She then ended up in an abusive relationship with another Yakuza member. And finally, she got pregnant, was able to get rid of the Yakuza boyfriend, and renounced the Yakuza in a very kind of interesting way, is that she had a full body tattoo, which we see in the film. You don't see the whole body, but you see enough of it to realize that this is somebody that's taken their own destiny in their own hands. And she wrote a best-selling novel in Japan about her experiences. And so it was a kind of cathartic way of dealing with these abusive relationships that she was in. Mm-hmm. And I found her to be absolutely fascinating. And she's certainly got my sympathies.
Yeah, sure. So this is the actual woman that you have in the film.
Correct.
Wow. Yeah. Well, for those of you listening, if you want to follow us, the website is edgewest.com. That's the name of your film company, right?
Yes, we're a boutique production studio here in Los Angeles in Santa Monica. Company's called Edge West, and we produce about 5-6 films a year. One of our major clients is Natural Geographic, and we have been sort of churning these, I think, pretty damn fine documentaries out for the last 6 years since I got here. It's been a great experience, a learning curve on every show.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine, yeah. And let's see, so it's going to premiere tomorrow night, Friday at 9 p.m. Pacific and Eastern Time, at National Geographic. So you're saying they're your clients, so you've worked with them for a while, huh?
Yeah, National Geographic have been great to me. I've made 17 or 18 films for them in the last 6 years.
Holy cow.
I see. So it's like home for you.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
you don't have to sell them hard.
They've been great to me and offered me some great opportunities to do projects that I really wanted to do and for which I'm very pleased with them. And I think long may that relationship continue.
Yeah. Amazing. Well, congratulations to you for that. I mean, the film looks very fascinating to me. I'm going to be watching this. And again, the film is Crime Lords of Tokyo. And we're talking to Phil Day. Phil, thanks so much for joining us. It's been great. And do you have any other films in the works right now?
We do, actually. We just delivered a great new series, which is a total departure from Crime Lords of Tokyo. Mm-hmm. It's a series called Party Like, and is about the greatest parties in history and how they affected the individuals and the history around them. So Marie Antoinette, for instance, was one of the greatest party animals the world's ever known. And her partying ways caused the French Revolution, which changed European history.
Right.
So it's a sort of different look through history.
Yeah. I'm excited about that one. That's in pre-production right now?
No, we've just delivered it. So it'll be airing in January, 3 1-hour shows that we're very proud of. And then we're starting on a film which is National Geographic's very first fully scripted drama, an hour's drama, about a subject matter I'm not allowed to talk about just yet. But suffice to say, it's an action-packed, science-based show that we'll be filming in December.
Show or documentary?
Yeah.
Documentary. Well, I always get confused.
A drama. It's actually that this one's fully scripted drama, so it's scripted, so it's fiction.
Right. I see.
Yeah. But based in fact.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Well, if you need a beautiful, talented actress, there you go.
Ta-da!
She's available for
Stephanie,
all kinds of film work.
Thank you very much. I will certainly put you on our record.
Thanks, Sam.
Okay, Phil Day, thank you so much for joining us. All the best. Everybody watch it tomorrow night on National Geographic. And all the best to you. Good luck. Thanks for spending the morning with us.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, and Steph, thank you as usual. And we'll see everybody tomorrow.
Bravo.
You've been listening to Sam and Steph in the Morning, which airs every weekday from 10 to 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, only right here on LA Talk Radio. If you have a question for one of our hosts, or if you would like to inquire about starting your very own talk radio show, please direct all correspondence to info@latalkradio.com. Sam and Steph in the Morning is a production of LA Talk Radio, where we say what we want.